Hello, and welcome to the third lecture of British Literature. Today we'll be discussing Geoffrey Chaucer's famous Canterbury Tales and taking some more notes on the medieval period in England. In the 13th, 14th, and 15th centuries, poets held a very different position in society than they do today. First, they couldn't rely on a literate audience, therefore all their work needed to be memorized and spoken. Second, unless their work was recorded and copied, only those who heard the poet would know his work. Thus, the poet experienced a twofold dilemma. If he was good, he was greatly desired in courts for providing regal entertainment. But if he was unknown or unpopular, he was obliged to live the life of a beggar. It goes without saying that medieval poets had other skills, skills like translating, lecturing, teaching. Sometimes they were even clergymen. People, from the courts to the streets, looked to the poets not only to provide entertainment, but to supply lessons on how to live a good life and how to avoid living a bad life and ending up in hell. Poets, in some ways, held the position of moral guardians or watchdogs. Therefore, most of what we call medieval literature is focused on the afterlife, or the moral life. Poems, sermons, theatrical skits ultimately surrounded the high drama of free will and man's choice between good and evil, heaven and hell. In most of the romances, like the Romance of Roland or the Romance of Arthur, the plot moves along based upon the testing of a knight. The poets knew what every wise man knew, that this world was a battlefield and that the world often tests man's strengths as a physical, moral, and spiritual creature. With that in mind, we also need to mention the condition of the church during the Middle Ages. I said in last week's lecture that the church became the political authority since there was no centralizing government of sorts. No one king held nearly as much power as the pope, or as much land, or as much manpower as the church. So the church, while possessing supreme spiritual authority, was also burdened with supreme political authority. To those members of the church who lived the devout life, political authority proved to be loathsome. After all, how can a priest or bishop rule justly over matters such as land disagreements or taxation of peasants? That duty was never meant to be his duty. The integrity of the church, therefore, suffered in two ways. First, church leaders sometimes became preoccupied with secular matters. Second, because the church was so powerful and had so much wealth, it attracted men and women of not such holy character. Men saw that money could be made through the collection of alms. Some priests even thought to charge for dispensing the sacraments, charging the people money for baptisms, marriages, etc. This, of course, is known as the sin of simony. Because priests and nuns belonged to the church, they consequently held a position of honor among the common people, and that position of honor commanded respect. So even if you were a criminal at heart, so long as you wore a habit, you could go about among the laity and command respect and expect generous and kind treatment. So poets were not blind to the abuses going on in the church, and often their poetry or dramas reflect a desire to get back to the basics of the message of the gospel. As artists, they strove to represent the ideal, whether that was found in the individual, the state, or the church. Where they found corruption, they often made it the subject of criticism, as we find in William Langland's Vision of Piers Plowman. If it was not the subject of criticism, it was the subject of ridicule, as we sometimes see in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. The literature we're looking at this week is, in fact, Canterbury Tales. As you read the selection in your text, be attentive to where Chaucer finds corruption and how it's portrayed. Chaucer uses an objective narrator to present characters, settings, and episodes before us. He has characters speak for themselves and lets us, the readers, draw our own conclusions regarding their moral worth. Before we begin discussing the prologue, I'll give you some notes on the Canterbury Tales themselves. To begin, the plot evolves out of a pilgrimage. 29 pilgrims, or 29 sundry folk, gather at the Tabard Inn, intending to make a pilgrimage to Canterbury Cathedral, the site where Thomas à Becket was murdered. Canterbury Cathedral was actually a place, a pilgrimage for citizens all over Europe, so quite likely the band of people one meets in Chaucer's poem would be much like the band one might meet on the road to Canterbury during any given day. For Chaucer's pilgrims, they travel in the spring. Anyways, these pilgrims are together at the Tabard Inn when their host suggests the pilgrims tell tales as a way of occupying their time on their journey. This suggestion quickly turns into a competition, and that, in the end, is what breeds the vast selection of Chaucer's tales. The characters range to fit into one of three categories in medieval society. They're either going to fit in the aristocracy, the clergy, or the commons. For each member, Chaucer takes his time presenting detailed descriptions as fully human beings. That is, none of his characters really fall into one category or another of good or evil. They're a mixture of both. Each character suffers from something like pettiness or ignorance or pride or any other vice. And each character succeeds in some element of goodness. Chaucer's pilgrims represent the whole of humanity, and Chaucer takes advantage of his poetic medium to both hold them up for admiration and to expose how each of these groups fail to fulfill their obligations toward one another and to God. Reading Canterbury Tales is somewhat of a challenge. The tales are written in Middle English, which is a lot easier for you to understand than Old English, and it bears a close resemblance to modern English, as you can see. But it's taxing nonetheless. The editor, much to your advantage, has printed the first 18 lines in both Middle and Modern English, so you're not stuck reading the rest in Middle English. You have a chart in the introduction that explains which combination of consonants and vowels create which sounds. Nevertheless, I will now read these lines so that you can get a feel for the poetry. Juan that April with his shower sota, the draught of March hath pierced to the rota, and bathed every vein in sweet liquor, of which virtu engendered is the floor. When Zephyrus ache with his sweete breath, inspired hath in every holt and heath, the tendra crapus and the younger son, hath in the ram his half a course he run, and smaller fowls making melodia, that sleep in all the night with open eye. So pricketh him that cure and hear courageous, then longing folk to go on pilgrimages, and palmers for to seek in stranger strands, to fare in the hallways cause in sundry lands, and specially from every shire's end of England to Canterbury they wend, the holy blissful martyr for to seke, that him hath holpen when that they were seke. I know that wasn't perfect Middle English, but it should give you an idea about how the poem is supposed to sound and the rhythms of the poetry. The introduction to this poem, as to any essay, is important. The setting and the purpose are given. We're also introduced to Chaucer's language. He bothers to fill his sentences with concrete, sensory details. His lines are metrical, that is, each line has 5 feet, or 5 accented syllables. Listen to lines 41 through 44. A knight was with us, and an excellent man, who from the earliest moment he began to follow his career loved chivalry, truth, open-handedness, and courtesy. Did you hear the rhythm? There's 5 feet per line. This kind of narration is called the metrical tale, the mode in which Chaucer wrote. The piece of prologue that you have printed in your reader introduces 7 characters and 5 guildsmen, a sampling of the variety of people making up the pilgrimage. We have every class represented: women, clergy, knights, students, merchants. Notice how with each character, Chaucer conveys character through physical description. We, in our modern age, have come a long way from associating character traits to physical features. But during the medieval ages, character traits had meaning. For instance, wide nostrils or gapped teeth indicated a lustful character. A broad forehead indicated intelligence. A ruddy complexion, or, you know, red cheeks, conveyed gluttony. Height, someone who's tall, conveyed nobility, while someone who was short conveyed peasant stock. The color yellow, whether found in blonde hair or a tunic or a cloak, expressed cowardice. Okay, so pay attention to the physical details given about characters. It gives you an idea about who they are. For instance, the knight is described as having rusted mail, a good horse, and plain gear. These details complement his character of integrity, open-handedness, and courtesy. We know he's a good knight, not only because he serves the king and has fought in the Crusades, but because he is meek and gentle and has never spoken ignobly in all his days to any man. For those of Chaucer's audience who knew, this knight was the perfection of knighthood and followed the code of chivalry to the T. Look next at the young squire. He is described as young, reaching moderate height, and with curly hair. He's dressed in colorful and bright clothing, whose coat was short, its sleeves long and wide. If we pay attention to such details, neither Chaucer nor I should need to tell you that this squire is somewhat of a showboat. He's here on a pilgrimage hoping to capture someone, a woman's attention. And so we have our first taste of Chaucer's sarcasm. Chaucer spends a little more time on the nun, and her character is expressed through physical description as well. Until she sings in a becoming way, she speaks French and takes care of eating primly, trying to imitate court ways. We're told her heart belongs to the poor animals, the mice in the trap or the starving dogs, and that she is overweight. There's a little piece of description saying that she was not undergrown. And do you remember what technique Chaucer's using here? He's using the technique of litote, understatement. She was not undergrown means that she was fat. Yet, if we're looking at all these descriptions, nowhere does the narrator tell us that this nun cares for the poor. Simply by omission of this detail, especially in light of all the other details given to describe her sympathy, Chaucer's casting a critical eye on the nun. While she possesses many fine qualities, she lacks true charity. Reading Chaucer's characters correctly requires close attention. Nowhere in her description does Chaucer come out and tell us that his nun is prideful and given to petty behavior, but he doesn't need to. His description allows us to draw that conclusion. Although Chaucer's critical of the nun, he's complimentary to other members of the church, especially the parson. Chaucer praises the parson for possessing the virtues of modesty, purity, courage, piety, wisdom, patience, kindness, and steadfastness. But although the parson receives a glowing report, Chaucer doesn't allow the reader to forget the prevalence of all the other insufficient parsons. This parson is singled out because he performs his role well. He doesn't throw his power around, and he doesn't leave his parishioners in their despair. He teaches and does not condemn. Most of all, he avoids mercenary exploits, especially the sin of simony. Lines 276 to 284 read, "By his own purity a priest should give the example to his sheep how they should live. He did not rent his benefice for hire, leaving his flock to flounder in the mire and run to London, happiest of goals, to sing paid masses in St. Paul's for souls, or as chaplain from some rich guild take his sheep, but dwelt at home and guarded well his sheep, so that no wolf should make his flock miscarry. The Canterbury Tales never leaves us feeling disgusted with the human condition, but neither are we allowed to forget the various levels of hypocrisy practiced in every corner of society. As sinners, men are incapable of escaping some form of hypocrisy, and Chaucer was wise enough to see that. In conclusion, I hope you understand that Canterbury Tales is both a literal pilgrimage of 29 particular characters to Canterbury, and it's also a metaphor for the spiritual pilgrimage that we all need to make if we are to see God. The tales serve a warning of caution about who and what we judge, lest we be judged. It also warns that the road to beatitude is full of imperfection, evils, temptations, on top of great beauty and joy. So that's all for Lecture 3. In Lecture 4, we will discuss one tale, the tale you have in your book, The Nun's Priest's Tale. So stay tuned, work well, and I'll speak to you again next week.